Okay, Gloria?
Uh-huh.
Let me do a brief introduction. Everybody is listening to this because we got no way to turn it off, but we're on the internet. I'm Ray Hill. Producer of this program is Elizabeth Stein. Jim Skelton, an attorney, is in the studio with me, part of the staff. Gloria is in Huntsville at the Walls, where the execution will occur. And Dave Atwood is in Houston at a vigil at a Methodist church on South Main. And these routines are pretty regular things whenever we have an execution. This is Texas Execution Watch. I'm Ray Hill. Every time Texas executes somebody, we will come into this studio and we will produce a show about that execution and the developing news that affects execution issues around the country. We have a one-hour program. It is now 6 o'clock Houston time. And our first voice you're going to hear on the show is Gloria Ruback, who is at the Walls. Gloria, what is happening there?
Well, I think the clocks here at Huntsville are a little early, but the media, the news media just walked across the street. I saw Michael Grishuk with the Associated Press and three or four other people just walk in with him. I'm assuming, well, I don't know who, if Alvin Kelly's sister and family are standing out here, so I don't know if anybody's going to go in there with him. I'm with Christy from New Mexico, who was visiting on death row today, and Christy said that the two people, the only two people that visited him were his daughter and his mother. Is his mother older? Yeah, because Alvin's not young. So I'm assuming the mom is probably at the hospitality house. The daughter is standing across the street crying, holding a black bandana up over her face. And I'm not seeing anybody else go in. But the media has gone in, which means that the execution should be taking place pretty soon. The victim's family goes in earlier, and I don't know even where they go in. We don't see them anymore crossing the street from the administration building into the Walls unit.
How many demonstrators are there, Gloria?
One, two, three, four. Here come his family. That's his mom. Oh, my God. His mother has long...
Yeah, that's the woman I saw.
His mother and some other family members are going in. Oh, my God, there's Catherine Wilcox.
Catherine's there?
Yeah, that looks like Catherine. Did you see that lady with the white shirt and the gray hair today?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's with the Salvation Army in Dallas. So Miss Wilcox is going in, and he's got a large... Oh, Catherine's got her head bowed.
She was there visiting someone else today. She was visiting Kevin.
And that's his mom in the red?
In the first place.
Oh. Okay. His family members are walking up the steps now and entering the Walls unit. And there's, there's more family members that have come out here now, judging by the tears. At least one, two, three, four. And then there's another one, two, three, four, five, six. Seven, eight, nine of us out here protesting and channel something, the Eyes of East Texas, channel 19, the Eyes of East Texas has a satellite truck in the parking lot. They've got a couple of media people up at the top of the hill here, but the TV station from Longview said they weren't allowed to go up there, so I don't know what's going on with the media tonight. Okay. Well,
okay.
Ray,
Gloria, we're gonna leave you and get back into the studio, and we will. If anything happens, call Elizabeth, and we'll get you on as quickly as possible.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Okay. Bye bye. And that was Gloria Ruback, our reporter in Huntsville, and Gloria routinely makes that journey when there is an execution. Jim Skelton is in the room. Jim, you have some problems with this case.
Yeah, I've read all the opinions on it, and the first thing that struck me when I first read it, because you have an instance where a man and a woman and a 22-month-old kid are killed, And what this has all the earmarks when you first look at it is somebody killing somebody for revenge. When you first look at the case, when they kill a 22-month-old baby, you think of the deals that happen in Mexico where there's some type of someone not paying off a drug deal and they're killing the whole family for revenge. It doesn't strike me as being the sort of thing the state claimed that they were killing these people because they were reserve city marshals and getting information to the police. That's what police do. I mean, that's nothing unusual about that.
Well, Alvin Kelly is 57 now, and he was 33 when the murders took place, and they took place in East Texas. Is there anything about the age of the victims? Are they about the same age as him?
No, I'm assuming they're fairly young because they have a 22-month-old child, and I got the impression they were probably in their late 20s. I didn't find anything in the opinions. That was my impression.
Well, he would have been 33, so
right.
that's in the same range.
Right. And see, the theory behind the state's case was that these two folks had been reserve deputy officers, and they were informing the police about his drug activities, and that's why he killed him. But that doesn't have a ring of truthfulness to it, because generally that's what policemen do. They tell other policemen when they find out about things. Plus, what really bothered me about this case, Race, whoever did the killing drove the pickup, or the, when the pickup is a Catalina Pontiac car, away from the murder scene.
Mm-hmm.
And the pickup, I mean, the car was taken to Tyler, dumped, and about two blocks away, somebody stole the pickup. But the initial theory was the killer drove the car away from the scene, then stole the pickup. And they traced the pickup to a group in Dallas, and when they got in Dallas, they arrested two African-American men in the pickup. And a necklace who was identified as belonging to one of the lady involved in the killing was found in the pickup. And what the testimony at trials indicated, that after they did the killing, they drove the car over to a place and dumped it. Why in the world would they have taken their car and dumped it? That doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, a lot of things about this doesn't make sense to me. Now, granted, Kelly, was strung out.
Yeah, he was
on methamphetamine, which is pretty serious drug stuff.
Right,
and he was an enforcer for the local drug trafficking thing, and that's why these two reserve deputies had him in their sights for passing on information. Well, that might get close to motivation, but it would look to me like if they were expecting something for him, they would be on their alert if they saw him coming.
Here's what's even crazier. According to the state's case, Kelly and the guy involved in the killing, a guy named Reeves, go over to the murder victim's house a few days ahead of time and take with them Kelly's brother. And Kelly's brother later testifies at trial, who's also, by the way, involved in Kelly's drug dealing. And according to the testimony, Kelly threatened these people ahead of time. Now, it seems to me logically, if a man goes to somebody's house who are police officers and threatens them, he'd be in jail that night. But according to the state's case, Kelly goes over to the house with another man and his brother and threatens to kill these people before the killing took place. And he's still walking the streets. That doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, why would you take your brother when you're going to threaten somebody? When the killing took place, supposedly had his wife with him. Why in the world would he have his wife with him? He goes and kills some people.
Now, there was a time delay between when these murders happened and when they actually charged Kelly with the offense.
Oh, yeah. It's about 6 or 7 years. It was a long time.
6 or 7 years.
Yeah. What had happened after the killing took place, the first suspects they thought were the two black men they arrested in Dallas.
With the truck.
With the truck. And what happened shortly after, 35 days later, Kelly's roommate's killed, a guy by the name of Ford. And they found him killed, and they suspected Kelly being involved in that. And no one ever did anything until Kelly's ex-wife, who claimed she was present when the killing took place, she moves to Michigan and apparently tells her boyfriend. Her boyfriend then calls the police some 6 years later and says, I got information on the killing of the Ford case, which was Kelly's roommate, and the Morgan case, which with the family that was killed.
Now, and wait a minute. There is no tangible evidence at the scene of the crime connecting this case to Kelly.
Here's what's bizarre. According to the state's case, the first person killed was the husband. the mail. And then what happened, the lady, her name is Cynthia Ann, Cynthia May, comes in the house because she hears a baby crying. When she walks in the house, she said that the mother's holding the baby, or the mother's being held by Kelly up against the wall with a gun to her head. And she grabs the baby to shield the baby from what was going on, takes the baby to another room, and then she hears a gunshot and Kelly shoots the woman in the neck. Doesn't kill her. Then what he does, he takes her in the room, drags the body of the husband in the room where the baby is, lays him on the floor, lays her on the floor, shoots and kills the baby, shoots and kills the wife, kills three people with the .22, and there's not one shred of physical evidence at the scene connecting him to that scene. There's not any way, in my opinion, you can kill three people, start dragging their bodies around, and not leave some DNA evidence or leave some evidence
of fibers
or something.
It
doesn't make any sense.
Of course, you understand that he insists that he is innocent of these killings.
Well, what's interesting about this, and again, I couldn't verify this, but he admitted guilt in the Ford killing of his roommate and got 30 years. And he claims they offered him on three different occasions a life sentence if he would plead guilty on these cases. And anybody with any sense would realize that in East Texas, if you're a drug dealer and you kill two people involved in law enforcement, plus the 22-month-old baby, they're going to execute you
Absolutely.
In a heartbeat.
No question.
And he would never, in my opinion, turn down three offers of a life sentence. I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me unless, in fact, he didn't do it. He admitted the other killing. He didn't have any. He entered a plea of guilty.
He did it, right. Yeah.
Right. But he's always
and he insisted as late as this week that he is not guilty of these killings.
Well, see what they never explained? The necklace they found in the pickup truck that was taken from the scene. The necklace they found, they never explained how that got in the pickup truck and what happened. The state later on claimed that the witnesses of the family who identified the necklace recanted, and this really wasn't her necklace, but then the necklace has disappeared.
So this is an East Texas prosecutorial mess.
Kind of like one of those Oklahoma cases, you know, they have them in Oklahoma where they have all the thieves.
Yeah, once in a while it happens in Louisiana, too.
Yeah, Oklahoma is the one that's really known for it, though.
But the deal is that apparently he's ready to be executed. I saw a video of him cut within the last couple of weeks where he says that going to an execution is like graduating to the Lord.
Well, all I can say about that is that people who believe in going to paradise are not anxious to get there. They do every damn thing they can to avoid it. So I'm not too sure that's true.
Well, Jim, in the overall, I mean, you and I have been looking at quite a few cases here. And some of these cases have a plausible claim of innocence that somehow or other falls through the cracks. What can you tell us about the legal history of this case?
Well, first off, on the legal history, they developed all of this on writ hearings. What happened? When they took the case up at the Court of Criminal Appeals, Court of Criminal Appeals affirmed it. Then the 1107 writ that filed later, that was affirmed. And they had a real thorough hearing in federal court, in which their major allegation was that he was convicted on perjured testimony. Because here's what convicted him. His former wife came down and testified she was present at the killing. And she testified that he did the killing.
Well, if she was present at the killing, isn't she basically under the law of parties? So?
Well, and they said that she didn't do anything to aid or assist. She couldn't have been charged with it. She was just a passive observer. Because according to her, she went up there with them. She didn't know what they were going to do when they go into the house. She hears an argument and hears gunfire, and she gets out. And that's at that point, the man's already killed. A guy named Jerry Morgan's already shot and killed. And at that time, Kelly, supposing to her, is holding Brenda Morgan up against the wall, and she grabs the baby. And then at that point, Kelly's supposed to shoot the lady in the neck, but doesn't kill her. Lays her down, then the baby starts crying, and apparently, according to him, the baby shot next. And then they take the baby and the husband in the room where the baby is, lay the wife down, and what happens, the wife is begging. Brenda May Cummings is the woman's name.
And she didn't come forward with any evidence for 6 or 7 years?
No.
I don't know how she dodged the law of parties.
What they said in this, and also, let me tell you what else they had. Morgan's brother, a kid by the name of Steve, who supposed is with Kelly ahead of time before the killing took place, he also testified that after the killing, all three of them, Kelly, a guy by the name of Reeves, mm-hmm. and Cynthia Mae Cummings go by his house. And they tell him, they admits to him he did the killing. Kelly tells him his own brother he did the killing. And gives his own brother the murder weapon. And borrows $500 from him. And leaves. They never found the murder weapon. It's never been turned over. It's never been found. That brother testified against Kelly. And then two more people testified. The wife's sister testified that Kelly was bragging about doing the killing. And then another man who just knew Kelly claimed that Kelly was an enforcer for drug stuff and mentioned the fact he'd killed some people over collecting money. Had mentioned that. So basically you have four people claiming he did the killing. And these, that's all they had. But there was absolutely no gun found. There was no physical evidence tying him to the scene. And what they tried to argue on all the appeals is that they were lying and they'd all cut deals with the states because everybody there was involved in drugs because the woman who testified was a methamphetamine addict and also a druggie. And her brother who testified was also a druggie and had pending charges. And they claimed they cut a deal with the state and that was never proven up. That was the basis of all the writs. But the problem was in federal court, since they didn't raise the issue in the state court, is a thing called procedural default. And then the trial judge, at least the writ judge, said he didn't think that any of the witnesses were credible. But see, forget all the witness stuff. It just doesn't make any sense.
The man was convicted on witness testimony. He wasn't convicted because of any tangible evidence.
No evidence. It's impossible, in my opinion, for someone to kill three people in a house.
And drag them around.
And drag them around, their bodies around.
Yeah, while they're bleeding and all of this going on, and not have some form of fiber or something show up that, well, I mean, we don't know the quality of the crime scene investigators in an East Texas town and things of that nature. There could have been a bunch of stuff there, but they would have.
Here's what's interesting. They did find some hair they claimed that came from African Americans. They swept the room, and they found some hairs that came from African-Americans. The two guys that were in the pickup truck in Dallas were both African-Americans, mm-hmm. and they did find hair fiber, and they found that hair fiber. They claimed that didn't belong to the two African-Americans that they picked up.
Okay.
But at least they went to that far, but yet there was not one shred of DNA evidence, one shred of anything to indicate that Kelly had been inside of that house.
Well, it's routine. I mean, in Houston and in Dallas and major cities, medical examiner's office is going to go over and go through the scene. In addition to the homicide division's own technicians are going to do a crime scene investigation. When you get off in East Texas, you got a sheriff's department that's generally in charge of that kind of activity unless it falls in the jurisdiction of a town or city. And the DPS makes up the gap. The Texas Department of Public Safety has crime scene investigators come in and secure the scene and do the investigation. So it's not as if there was no investigation done, or it's not presumably that the investigation was not thorough enough to find evidence that's routine enough to do that. I see why you've got problems with this case. There's just a lot of mess here. And, of course, at this point, the only thing that could keep him from being executed would be a application for clemency. And I do not know if one was filed. Do we have any information about that,
no,
Elizabeth? We don't have any information on that. From the videotape that I heard of him made within the last couple of weeks, he is saying that he's tired of living on death row. It's no way to live. He's through. And he is placing himself. He actually calls it a graduation, which is, I think, kind of bizarre. Why don't Elizabeth has some good music picked up that is related to the topic. We will play that, and we'll come back. Hopefully we hear from Gloria. You might check with Gloria during the music. My name is Ray Hill. I've been talking with Jim Skelton about the case of the execution tonight. A fellow by the name of Kelly, who has been charged and is being executed in the deaths of Glenn Morgan and Gail Morgan. and a 22-month-old child, Devin Glenn Morgan. And we'll be back in a few minutes.
Oh, it is. They never...
And the music you've been hearing is from the Logan Collection, from the Library of Congress, Logan Collection Library of Congress. Put Dave on. Dave?
Yeah.
It's Ray Hill. What's going on where you are?
Well, here you, Ray, I'm down at the corner of Main Street and Bins. This is where we're having our local protest today.
Yes, sir.
And we've got about a dozen people here, which is a pretty darn good turnout for. For, you know, the fact that we have these all the time. And one of the good things, Ray, is that, you know, we've been doing this for, I think I've been doing this for about 15 years now. And when we first started doing these protests in Houston, we would get about, you know, I'd say 75% of the people, if they responded, would be give us a thumbs down. They were against what we were doing. But now it's just the opposite. We get an awful lot of people who give us a thumbs up, who agree with us, and I call it the street corner polling, and because I see a real difference in how people are responding to this subject just out amongst the general public.
Dave, our report from Huntsville is that the witnesses have not come out yet.
Okay.
So that means that the process is ongoing.
Right.
And so my question to you is, we've got a dozen of these things scheduled beginning tonight and going through Thanksgiving.
Right.
And that's an awfully busy schedule. Do you have any comments about that?
Yeah, it's a horrible schedule, Ray. It just is horrible to think that we would have 12 executions scheduled October and November, and you know, I don't know if they're going to bring some out for December or not. I would be surprised if they didn't have something in the early.
Well, actually, they openly say that they stop executing between Thanksgiving and Christmas because of the quote holiday season.
Yeah, well, you know, that's good, but they haven't always done that in the past. Maybe there's. Maybe they're starting to think about those things a little bit more.
Well, Elizabeth Stein has written an essay that said, why would they defer on the anniversary of the world's most famous capital punishment victim?
Right.
Stop exercising capital punishment because of his birthday.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's the hypocrisy. The brutality of what everything that goes on is just incredible. I mean, they just a lot of the people that are involved in these executions call themselves Christians, you know, and it makes you begin to wonder what are they really talking about, what do they really know about it, and but to have this many executions scheduled, you know, 12 in 2 months, most states that have the death penalty on the books, and we have 36 states that have the death penalty now. Most states don't have 12 executions in 5 years, and we're having 12 executions in 2 months.
What about the cost of all of this? What does it actually cost?
Well, you know, the only study that we have for Texas, although it's been borne up by studies in other states, showed a differential of about $1.5 million more expensive to have the death penalty rather than, say, a life sentence. So if you multiply out $1.5 million by the number of executions that Texas has had, and we're up at today, if this does go forward today, this will be 415 since 1982, so that, you know, you just multiply those numbers out, and it's a really, really big number. You know, I guess, what, $500 million or something like that.
And Dave, are you affected by the claim of innocence in this case? Alvin is insisting that Alvin Kelly is insisting that he did not commit this crime. He said, I've killed other people and I've confessed to it, and if I did it, I would confess to it.
What he said publicly was very, very convincing, but you know, I can only come to conclusions on those types of things myself, Ray, if I talk to the person's attorney, which I haven't done. And I have had, you know, with other cases, I've had like a private conversation with the attorney where nothing was going to go public and just asked, and I haven't done that with Kelly, but
you know, there's not much difference in the ritual among those who claim to be innocent and those who readily say, yeah, I did it and I'm ready to go. And I, well, actually, Alvin Kelly is saying he's ready to go because he's tired of living on death row. And
that's understandable to a great extent. Certainly, for those brutal conditions that we have up there, I can understand why somebody would say, you know, I'm ready to give it up and go ahead and get this over with. You know, Ray, I was talking to a lady from Germany the other day who had just visited somebody on death row, and she was on her way back to Germany. And I asked her, I said, what's the worst punishment you get in Germany for murder, you know, the most heinous murder? And she said, 15 years. And I said to her, you know, I had almost the reaction of a typical Texan saying, well, you know, 15 years, what happens after 15 years? Do they get out of prison and then go out and create mayhem, you know, and kill and do all these horrible things? She said, no, that doesn't happen at all. And I said, well, why is that? And she said, well, it's because during those 15 years, we really make a very, very strong effort to rehabilitate the person. And so when these people come out of prison, the great majority of them at least have been rehabilitated. And they don't do anything anymore.
Well, Dave, we appreciate you standing by. Give our regards to those present. We'll get back in touch with you if we hear word from Austin that the process is completed.
You take care.
Yes, sir.
Bye-bye.
And that was Dave Atwood, and he is located at St. Paul's Methodist Church on Main Street at Ben's, where the local folks gather. And local folks over there, usually some folks from St. Thomas University, some folks connected with the Archdiocese downtown, and they gather Catholic-dominated groups opposed to execution in all cases. The 12 executions in 6 weeks. Jim, you got any comment about that production schedule?
You know, I think Texas Monthly just did an article recently about a DA out in Pecos, Texas, in Monahans, and the reason they didn't seek the death penalty out there very much because it cost too much money to do it. And I think maybe this is a product of Texas affluence. We have so much money in Houston that they don't really worry about killing people. I don't think that people in Houston are more readily to kill than somebody else. I just think the DA's office is more likely to seek the death penalty here because aren't that pressure of money in this particular city, because we're fairly wealthy. And some of these smaller towns, they simply can't afford death penalty cases. They can't afford to pay for
Dallas has a new district attorney who takes a longer, slower look at all of this than has been done in the past in Houston. Do you expect there to be any change in the pattern in Houston? We do get either one who wins the election, we get a new DA in Harris County.
Well, ironically, as a matter of fact, today on the radio station here at Pacifica, they had a debate between Pat Likas, who's running for judge, and Bradford, who's running for judge. And both of them are strong supporters of the death penalty, but they claim they're going to review it better than what they've did in times past. And I think what will make the major impact are two different things. One of them, we now have life without parole.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, I think the public is kind of turning against the death penalty more so than they were in times past. And I think the fact that they can now try a capital murder not seeking the death penalty and get life without parole will not be nearly as expensive as seeking the death penalty. I think that will have a major impact on them not seeking the death penalty. And I think that, as a general rule, people are not as inclined to be for the death penalty they were to begin with. I think those will be the two major things, because truthfully, either Likas or Bradford, either one, are politicians. And like politicians, they're going to go whichever way the wind blows. And I think that the wind blows in Texas pretty much is to kill people. And if you read the blogs and stuff, and it's frightening when you read some of the comments made in newspapers about everybody seems to be so bloodthirsty in this state. And I think that's probably typical of most Texans.
Well, actually, people with available resources to afford the best representation, they're rarely charged with capital cases.
Well, we just had a case, Ray. Remember the little girl who was convicted and bobbed in a series of killings down in Clear Lake? She had Mike DeGuerin. I'm sure he didn't do it at Walmart prices.
Sure.
And she got convicted, and she gets an automatic life sentence. So there are exceptions to that rule. Markham Duff Smith's an exception to that. There are a few exceptions. As a general rule, most crimes that are capital murders are done by people who are economically stressed to begin with. I mean, most rich people don't rob 7-Elevens.
Yeah.
Most rich people don't kidnap and rape.
Yeah.
They rape the stock market, and they do things more like the end.
Well, I mean, once in a while we'll get a big real estate broker from New York come down here, and something funny happens, and you get a trial.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he's got the resources to make that a difficult thing for the state. I mean, you just literally outbid the state if you got enough money.
As a matter of fact, I've told my law class, we've laughed about that. They're always talking about high crime areas. Recently, River Oaks has now become the high crime area because you want to talk about a high crime area. Enron made most of River Oaks a high crime area.
More police calls in River Oaks per address than anywhere else.
Well, up until Enron, a high crime area meant a black neighborhood. Now they've kind of spread it out a little bit.
Spread it out. It used to mean Montrose. Montrose has quieted down considerably.
Yeah.
We missed one of these things
yes.
Because of the storm. When we got into this, we made a commitment that we were going to come in here and talk about it. But during in the middle of the hurricane, while Ike was assaulting, Texas prison system carried out an execution. And this is the William Murray case. And William Murray was he raped and strangled a 93-year-old woman, according to the case.
Right. What had happened, his mother apparently had been working as a nurse on nurse care in this lady's home.
Mm-hmm.
Murray had been in the penitentiary on a burglar case and been out about 10 months. He went back to using drugs again. And I'm just assuming since his mother had been in doing some home care in the home, he knew about this lady. He needed some money that night. So he goes to this old lady's house to rob her. And he ends up getting like $10. And what happens, she hears him burglarizing the house, and she jumps up and whacks him with her cane, because you don't mess with old ladies.
Yeah,
they'll whack you, whack you
in a minute,
good.
Right.
And so he said he just went nuts, and he strangled her, raped her, wrapped an ace bandage around her neck, and stuffed it in her mouth when they found her. And apparently it was a pretty brutal killing, because according to the pathologist report, she died of multiple head injuries plus being strangled to death with an ace bandage. But unlike the case, that the Kelly case that they're executing tonight, this guy readily admitted. In fact, he went home and told his mother about it. He told him. I think he called Rush Limbaugh and told him. He told everyone.
Do you get the impression that this guy was playing with a full deck?
No, I don't think so at all. I don't think he was crazy or retarded. He was just, I don't know. He just got to, see, here's what bothers me. And I've talked about this before. No one has ever held the penitentiary accountable for creating a dangerous person and turning them loose. Because it's been my theory, especially if it's a fairly young person, that when they go to the pen, the way they're treated, they're more dangerous when they get out than when they go in, primarily because of a lot of ways TDC treats
they
people.
They certainly go back to prison with a higher rate than those that wind up not going in the first place.
Well, and a products liability case, if I turn something loose on society, then I get held accountable for it. If I make a lawnmower wax off somebody's leg. But none of these victims' families have ever sued TDC for the dangerous product they're turning loose on the streets. And here this guy's been on parole. He's a fairly young man, raving hormones anyway. And he said he lost it. You have a lot of rage, and that rage was built up. When did it build up? It built up when he was in the penitentiary. He just got out. And yet no one's ever held our institutions accountable. For example, back when Will Gray, this was about 15 years ago, I was helping Will with a series of death penalty cases. And I went up to death row then, and I was shocked to discover that about a third of the kids on death row had been raised in reform schools.
Hmm.
And it's kind of like when I got back, I kept thinking, we just raise these kids like we do quail.
Yeah, but they weren't reform schools. They were really children's prisons in those
exactly.
days.
Exactly. And they were beating the hell out of people.
Sure.
And then they wonder why you had these bad products you turned loose on the streets. And I've always been amazed about that, because this guy just got out of the pen. He's full of some sort of rage. And where did that rage come from? The rage had to come from the way he's treated when he was incarcerated. And that happened to be the lady that he unloaded on happened to be the product of that rage that the TDC and itself created. Exactly. And we've never really explored that, about the fact that we make a product that's more dangerous when it gets out of jail than when it goes in. For example, if you had a hospital and people were diseased, and you put them in it, and then when they're released, they're 10 times more diseased before they came, you'd close the hospital down.
Sure.
There'd be an outrage about it. And to me, this is an example, because in both of these cases, what are interesting, there is no evidence in the Murray trial that he ever came from an abusive childhood. Because your typical capital murder case is young kid raised by abusive parents, get beat up as a kid, gets mm-hmm. in trouble, and not too bright.
Mm-hmm.
And usually you have a time bomb going when that occurs. In both of these cases, for example, Kelly was raised by apparently a good family. He went into the Marine Corps. That's the only thing I was suspicious about.
Yeah.
These Semper Fi fools, I just simply don't trust these Semper Fi people. But he is in the Marine Corps. Honorably discharged, gets mm-hmm. out, starts running a diesel truck stop, gets hooked on methamphetamine, because hanging around truckers, I'm sure he got yep. plenty of methamphetamine,
sure.
And then he got involved in the drug culture, and then he went downhill from there. In this particular case, Murray, there's nothing from the trial transcripts indicating he was ever had an abusive childhood, nothing but a low IQ.
Mm-hmm.
He was just a kid that was a little bit reckless and crazy, like a lot of people are, and went to prison, had a lot of rage when he got out, and this rage
unloaded
on him.
You and I know people, you and I in our actual life have known people that are in the same category that don't go end up killing people. Now, Kelly did kill someone. It was his
roommate.
We're still up in the air whether he's being executed for a murder that he actually committed. And you know, I remember, what was his name? The Attorney General, Jim Maddox, actually leaned on George Bush and got him to stay the execution of, what was that old feller's name? That had confessed so many crimes.
The Texas Ranger guy had claimed he had sex with his mother.
Killed his mother.
Yeah. I've forgotten his name, but he claimed to have killed all these people.
And Jim Maddox just did the arithmetic. He said, "How did you get from this murder you committed in South Florida to Texas in time to kill this murder? It's only an hour and a half's difference." And Henry Lee Lucas told him, says, "Well, you watch Star Trek, don't you? That's the way you get around in a hurry." And so the deal is that there's some mean, nasty, ugly, evil people out there, but we ought not make it a practice of killing people for murders that they didn't do. If you're going to kill somebody, let's kill you for a murder that you did.
I couldn't see, and like I say, the Kelly case bothers me a great deal. I'm not saying he's a good guy, because he also, not only did he kill his roommate, he got thrown in jail for drugs while he was in jail.
He raped a couple of convicts while he was in there.
Had sexual assault, but he pleads on all of those. He pleads guilty on the murder case of his roommate, pleads guilty on the sexual assault of the two guys in jail. And if he had really done these murders, he should know what in these Texas jury
and the
would have
witnesses
done.
Here seem. Number one, that they didn't get charged under the law of parties. Had they been charged under the law of parties, can you actually execute somebody for uncorroborated witness from a co-defendant?
Unfortunately, in Texas, it doesn't take a hell of a lot to corroborate. For example, what they would do is corroborating. If I say I stabbed you with a butcher knife, and the pathologist said that the wound in the body is consistent with the knife that I described, they'll consider that corroboration.
Oh.
See, in this case, what they claim that the way this was corroborated, they claim the way that, and the woman involved that was at the killing was a woman named Cynthia May Cummings. Of course, at the time, she was married to Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they claim they corroborate what she had to say is that she described to the scene indicated she was there, because for example she told the police that there was a towel under the victim, one of the victim's head, and she told the police about that ahead of time, and they in fact found the towel. What Kelly's theory was that during the time of trial that she was in fact at the murder scene, he just wasn't there, that somebody else did the killing. And one of his theories advanced at trial is that she was involved with a black man and that the boyfriend and her did the killing. Because again, that killing has all the earmarks of somebody wanting to get revenge, because they killed the whole family plus a 22-month-old baby, and that usually
that's just like they go hog wild
right
in there. And there are murders like that.
Exactly. And usually it's an anger thing. It's usually somebody, you know, it's some type of revenge or anger when they do that type of killing. And according to this, and again, that going back over there, going there ahead of time and threatening those people just doesn't make any sense to me. That would never have occurred. Had that occurred, Kelly would have been in jail the next day.
Well, there's another case that's been cooking, and that's the one in Georgia.
Yes.
And
the one in Atlanta?
Yeah, the Supreme Court of the United States, which first stayed this execution. And we're talking about Troy Davis's case.
Right.
And Troy Davis's case, I think Gloria is on the air, so on the line, so let's put her on. Gloria, are you there?
Yes, I am, Ray.
What's happened, darling?
Well, I just gave a big hug to Catherine Cox. She said that Alvin, it took so long because he gave a long statement, and then he kept singing. She said he was singing to me the whole time. She was she was crying and laughing at the same time.
Yeah, well, Catherine she's not a virgin to this sort of thing.
Well, no, I was just introducing her to a friend that's with me from Albuquerque, and I said, I think Catherine's been visiting here for about 30 years. She goes, oh, no, 37.
Yeah.
So she could write the book on Texas Death Row.
Yeah, she's been the spiritual guide for so many people on Death Row, and they made her all kind of commanders in the Salvation Army, and she gave up all those titles, but she continues to do the work.
Right. And she, you know, I don't know how old she is now. She was old when I met her.
She's got to be in her 80s.
Yeah, I'm sure she is 80s. But she drives every week from Dallas by herself.
Yeah.
She was visiting on death row when her husband died. She was visiting when her son got killed in a car wreck, I think. And she's faithfully there every week.
So the process is complete.
The process is complete. He had actually a large group of family go in, and then five or six of them out here with us. And
does he have a website? Is that where they put that?
First year.
Yeah. Why don't you do a Google search on Alvin Kelly?
Texas Moratorium Network. If you go to their website.
Okay.
They have.
Do they have that videotape of his singing?
Yeah.
Okay. Texas Moratorium Network.
Texas Moratorium Network. I forget the...
Yeah, but just put that in your search engine, it'll pop up. Texas
exactly.
Moratorium Network.
If you just go down right under the announcement about the march, you can click on watch the video of Alvin Kelly.
Yeah, and if you're listening to this program, you're interested enough in the issue to understand that Texas is having a very important march coming up this month. When is that, Gloria?
It's Saturday, October 25th. Less than 2 weeks.
Absolutely.
And it's going to be at 2 o'clock, starting at Shape Center on Alameda, 3903 Alameda. And we're going to march from Alabama to Shape Center on Live Oak. And
okay.
Clarence Branley is going to be our featured speaker this year.
I understand Clarence made a cameo appearance at a recent workshop out at
St.
Thomas High School. I mean, St. Thomas College.
Right.
And my report, which came from our producer, Elizabeth Stein, said that he was laid back and cool, and that's exactly the way I remember him.
He was laid what?
Laid back and cool.
Oh, really? Good.
Yeah, it's not excitable, just the facts, ma'am. Joe Friday kind of guy. Who we are talking about, if you're not,
after 10 years of hell.
Yeah, if you're listening to this, who we're talking about is someone that a bunch of us, including Gloria and myself and all of Shape Center, was involved in as an exonerated death row person who literally did not do it.
Right. Coalition to Free Clarence Branley.
Yep. Okay. Gloria, thank you for your work helping us coverage.
Okay.
Where can people get information about the march?
Okay, Tuesday night, Christy, what's his name? There's an execution Tuesday night.
Thursday night, yes.
Unfortunately, I will not be here. I'm going to be speaking at Rice University, the student group Rice for Peace and Justice.
But we will be here. And
Yes, you will.
So tell the regulars up there. Give them Elizabeth's number, and if anyone wants to make a report from the scene Thursday, we'll be looking forward to broadcast.
Oh, well, you know, Dennis Longmire has already driven off, but I bet you he would do that. So I'll get in touch with him.
Yes, we have his number.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
Thank you, Gloria. Be safe coming home.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
And that was Gloria Ruback, our reporter in Huntsville. The process is completed. Alvin Kelly is now executed, and his family disperse and go back, and the demonstrators go their separate way. But let's get back to Troy Davis. That's another claim of innocence in a Georgia case. And do you know anything about that case?
All I know, it's much like the Alvin Kelly case, and mostly got eyewitness testimony, and that's about it, no physical evidence. I think the more interesting thing, though, Ray, is there's a case out of Ohio that a guy comes as too fat to be executed.
Yes, that's
now, Rush Limbaugh should jump on that. That'd be a fail-safe for Rush
Absolutely.
Limbaugh and all the right-wingers.
No telling, we're liable to have a change of political climate,
yeah.
And Rush Limbaugh would be a prime target.
That'd give him a fail-safe in case they decide to kill his sorry rear end. Because if you're too fat to execute, Rush Limbaugh should jump on that immediately.
Well, you know, he went on that crash diet, and that worked for about 3 weeks.
Well, the pills got him back on.
Yeah. Then he had to give up Oxycontin.
So I think that the right-wing radio would really jump on that. That's too fat to die. That'd be great.
Yeah, some of the preachers would get in on that.
Looking at the Republican convention, that'd save most of them, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. The killing machines just go on and on and on. But I thought this was a very interesting case, this Troy Davis case, because the Supreme Court of the United States granted him a last minute, literally, he was there, strapped down, fixing dying. They said, no, hold on, we won't think about this. And then 3 weeks later, they said, well, you can go ahead. What was going on there, Jim?
I didn't read the opinion. I have no earthly idea. But again, going back, Ray, with all the new DNA evidence that's come out, virtually every one of those involved instances where eyewitnesses claim somebody committed a crime, and they were absolutely dead wrong. And I think by now we should be real reluctant, especially in death penalty cases, to execute people based solely upon eyewitnesses without any DNA or physical evidence trying them to the scene, like in the Kelly case. Because all they had based were four people that said he did it, all of whom had some vested interest in testifying that he did it. And the same thing, the case in Atlanta. It's all based upon eyewitness testimony. And people should be very skeptical of that because DNA evidence has proven
that. Seven of the nine witnesses now have recanted.
Right, and they recanted their testimony.
And for three of them have an alternative person that did it, which was kind of interesting, said they were guided by the police in that case to testify. Dallas Morning News did an article this last weekend, a pretty comprehensive article about what is wrong with eyewitness testimony. And over the years on the Prison Show, we have looked into eyewitness testimony. We've looked into false confessions. You know, a great many people confess to things that they did not do. Usually they're not very bright. They usually don't give a damn whether they live or die. But there's a lot of things that the great unwashed just assumed. He said he did it, therefore that's the way that happens. But up at Williams College, Massachusetts, I went up there and interviewed a feller that specialized in analyzing cases where people wrongfully testify to serious crimes. And so the things that we depend on to convince juries and, of course, district attorneys and appellate judges that is justification for execution or long sentence and all that may not even be real. And I witnessed this article in Dallas Morning News, and I hope the listener will go to the Dallas Morning News website and read that article. It's the process of using photo lineups and how placement and the most subtle of hints from the officer displaying it, you wind up convicting the person the officer wants convicted, maybe having nothing to do with the case that it involves the witness at all. And which is, of course, what the Hurricane Carter case, Reuben Carter case, was all about. Reuben spent a long time. He wasn't executed. He spent a long time in a New Jersey prison for a crime that he did not commit because the officer had, as a juvenile officer, had quarrels with him when he was a kid.
There's also, if you've not heard of it, John Grisham, who usually writes fiction, wrote a book based upon a case that occurred in Oklahoma in which two guys get the death penalty. It's all based upon false confessions. As a matter of fact, they were all later exonerated, and both of them were released. One of them came very close to dying, and as a matter of fact, the DA, the police that were involved in it, all pretty well framed these two men, and they sued Grisham. In fact, last week or a couple of weeks ago, they granted a summary judgment for a libel case in Grisham's behalf. But he's written a book that talks about that very thing you're talking about. There was a murder case. A lady, a barmaid, was raped and killed. And they even hid fingerprints. There was a thumbprint on the wall that they lied about. And they got two guys to confess, and the way they did it, finally just got the charge of being bad as hell with it. Whatever you want to say, I'll agree to it. A good example that everybody should remember. Remember the movie My Cousin Vinny?
Yeah.
The guy was accused of killing the sheriff, and he said, "I killed the sheriff? I killed the sheriff?" in a rhetorical question. When it came down for trial, the sheriff testified, "I killed the sheriff. I killed the sheriff." Admitted it twice, when in fact it was a rhetorical question that he was asking. But yet that turned out to be in the form of a confession.
Mm-hmm.
And this book that Grisham wrote, both of them involved instances where the guys confessed. And they talked about what they called a dream confession. They had them kind of fantasize what the dream would be like.
That's the routine.
Right. And both of those were absolutely completely innocent. Both of them were later exonerated. One of them pretty well ruined a guy's life. And like I say, the DA's involved, and the two cops sued Grisham for libel, and they got their case poured out. An excellent book called An Innocent Man.
Well, Jeff Blackburn, and there's a documentary about Tulia, Texas. And Jeff Blackburn got that case, and I knew Jeff as a young radical. Mercy, if I ever run for president, they're probably going to beat me on the head because he was a lefty.
Your political radical career began in terrorist bedroom.
In terrorist law office, right. And but he's a good lawyer now, and he works his butt off, and he's the guy that handled that those Tulia cases.
Right.
And that's a case where an officer went undercover and just handed out big time. And the amazing thing is, of the people that got time, almost all of them pled, which is in a form of a confession. There were only a couple of trials.
It is a confession.
It is a confession.
It's called a judicial confession.
A judicial confession. But it was the plea bargain is, of course, supposed to be a bargain. If you can get 160 years and they offer you 40, that's a bargain. So you take it. That's why they call it. Is that why they call it plea bargaining? But at any rate, that's basically what Jeff's clients wound up in. And he was able to exonerate them. And now I think there's been 19 exonerations from Dallas County.
I think it's 22 now.
Is it 22?
The undercover officer went to prison.
The undercover officer in Tulia, Texas, wound up going to prison. I don't know whether he confessed or not, but he went to prison.
He got convicted for perjury, if you recall. In fact, he was the son, I think, of a very famous Texas Ranger. You know, and that's not too terribly unusual in narcotics cases. I remember about 20 years ago, there was a case out of Conroe where an undercover officer goes up there and kind of infiltrates the community. And what he was doing, they ended up indicting on those. Remember, he used to do those sealed indictments when they make these big raids on weekend, mm-hmm. arrest about 10,000 people. He went up there and made a bunch of drug cases, and they arrested 100-something kids on sealed indictments. And I represented about 5 or 6 of them. They all told me the same thing, that he'd invite them over to their house for drugs. They'd bring their drugs, and they'd smoke his, and he kept theirs. And every kid told me the same thing. And what was funny, that was back when George Wallace was running for president. A lot of these kids were on the school board, and I got to tell them with my long hair, "Now you got exactly what you wanted for, you jerks." It turned out, the way we won all the cases, it turned out that the narc was then started stealing evidence out of out of the evidence room and selling it in Louisiana, and got busted selling the drugs in Louisiana.
Which is not an uncommon story.
And in narcotics cases, that's real common. And see, this is one of the reasons that, too, the death penalty is such a bad thing, because there's so much pressure on a heinous murder. When there's a real bad crime, there's a lot of pressure for the police to solve it. And once they focus in on somebody, they're going to cut corners because of all the pressure and because the death penalty is available to try to make a conviction. And that's one of the better arguments against the death penalty. It literally corrupts our system. because you're going to, many of these instances where people are seeking the death penalty, the police are going to bend over backwards to make sure they convict people, and a lot of times they're going to fabricate evidence.
And you, the taxpayer, will, of course, pay for it all.
Right.
And I want to thank Jim Skelton.
You're welcome.
For coming in. And we have a kind of a perennial guest that comes in with you. She can participate in some of these things when she wants to. Our producer is Elizabeth Stein. I'm Ray Hill. And roving reporters tonight were Dave Atwood at the vigil here in Houston and Gloria Ruback in Huntsville. The execution of Alvin Kelly has been completed. And, by the way, we couldn't do any of this if it weren't for Otis McClay's engineering genius. We hope to be back on KPFT's HD2 channel soon. But in the meantime, we will continue on this internet broadcast, and thank you very much for going to the trouble to listen to it. My name is Ray Hill. This program is produced at the studios of radio station KPFT, Houston.